Telling Brother Charles, it's been actually quite a while since we've been here on a Sunday morning. We've been here on Sunday evening and Wednesday evening a few times, but it's been a while since we've been here on a Sunday morning. And so I wanted to share a video. I didn't know if who all had seen our video yet, so I just wanted to play that. Also, I wanted to give anybody that might have questions about not only our, you know, the broader. Our broader ministry, but maybe current status. I've told some of you know more. You all know differing levels of where we're at. So I will let you guys ask the questions, and I'll answer them. As you know, it probably won't be all that briefly because you know me. But I will try to answer them as precisely as I can. So how about that? And if there's maybe something specific you want me to address, just hint that direction. Yes, ma'am.
Have these devastating fires impacted those airfields or anything
over there? No. In fact, so I am one of those people that I don't go to CNN. I'm not a liberal, but I don't go to normal news sites to figure out information. In fact, there's a website that the federal government of Australia has that shows current wildfires and their status. And in fact, when I say current, I think it goes by each year. And so the current status of wildfires, including those that are no longer having an effect at all. And for some reason, their website is completely different than anything you find on any other news website. And I don't know why. So either the country, the federal government of Australia is incorrect, or the news is incorrect, one of the two. I can't tell you how many people have come up to me in the last few weeks and said, "So is there going to be a country when you arrive, or are you just going to be going to a smoking hole?" In fact, there's actually very little impact, to be honest, going on. The acreage numbers look very large, but you also realize that it is an entire continent. It's also very large in comparison to the United States. It's very similar size, and when you look at compared to the United States in terms of population, it's unbelievable. When you look at the two countries are very close in size, and the United States has 325, well, it's actually probably more like 350 or 360 million people in it, and and Australia has 24. So it's a vast difference in terms of numbers. So what does that tell you? Well, 70% of the continent is outback, and of the outback, maybe 10% of it is actually, maybe 20% of it is actually got people in it. So that seems like reducing it down too much. The people are just more spread out there. That's very much the case. Towns tend to be more like 2,500 people or 3,000 people instead of 25,000 people. In Oregon, we have this thing, I don't know what it is, about being in towns of 25,000 people. We have so many towns of 25,000 people in the state of Oregon. If you've never looked at that up, it's a very weird number to me. I don't know why. There's so many towns in Oregon that are that number, and I think people start to then, there are a lot of people in Oregon that see it getting up to 50,000 and they leave to find another one that's 25, right? That in Oregon compared to Australia, and especially in the outback, is more like 2,500 people. So they're much more spread out. The other thing is that if you superimpose the United States onto Australia and you looked at where the wildfires are actually located, most of them are down near Sydney, which would be like Sydney would be kind of like Atlanta, like Georgia area, and below that, which would be what kind of in the United States would be like Florida and Alabama, is completely uninhabited, almost entirely. It's like kids' camps out in the middle of the bush, and there's nothing out there. So that's where 90% of the fires are going on in the country, and there's very little out there. Oddly enough, I have a cousin that lives there, and she lost her house, which is, you might think, well, that may be not so hard to believe because there's a lot of people lost their house. There are actually not that many that have lost their houses. And this was a Christian camp that she was on that was really way out in the middle of nowhere. Four hours southeast of Sydney is barren. There is nothing out there. I mean, that's about as barren as you can get and still be in New South Wales. So it's not all that surprising. That's where these fires have mostly been. So there are other fires in the country, but nothing very significant at all. In Brisbane and in Queensland as a whole, there have been very, very, very few. In fact, now it looks like it's pretty much over anyway, what was going on, because the rains come and they're good. But this is their rainy season. So the summer is the rainy season there. The winter is the dry season. So this is the rainy season. And Brisbane is a lot like Florida in terms of climate. It's very muggy, rarely gets down into the 40s. You don't see rain in the winter at all. In fact, they'll go 4 or 5 months without seeing a drop of rain, and then they'll see rain all summer long. It's warm and hot and muggy. It's 95 degrees and pouring down rain, and it's, yeah, that's Queensland for you. And the farther north you go, the closer you get to what most people would describe as Amazon jungle. It's, you get up into the north, it's just tropic jungle is all it is up there. Very wet, so there's no fires up there. And so then the impact on the country itself in terms of the fires has been somewhat significant, but they're kind of pointing it out without giving you further information to show you that the country actually does its own controlled burns every single year on purpose, because they're smart, and it actually keeps things from turning into vast fires like this. And it actually renews the ground and lets them regrow, everything regrows pretty quickly. So they do this every year anyway, generally this time of year, going into the rainy season, so then the rain brings it in, and it's a pretty common thing. So that said, it's a little bit more than normal, so that's where the news is picking up on it, but I guess there was not enough things going on with Trump being impeached and all this stuff. They needed to come up with some other big news story to sell headlines. And once one person jumped on it, everybody else had to. I'm not totally downplaying it. I mean, they're somewhat devastating. But I still think that the wildfires this past year in California, significantly more devastating. More population involved, more houses. Just, yeah. And of course, the price of homes. Not even close. So, yeah. Anyway. It looks like it's all over now, or mostly. So, any other questions? Did I answer that? I hope I answered that. That was the short version.
Yes, you did.
Hello. We've been praying for you in the ministry, of course, and we've been praying for your schedule fill-up. Mm-hmm. How is that going?
It's getting better. It's slowly moving forward. So I do want to hit on this, actually, that brings up a point. I'll let you know what kind of our next big hit is. We leave on the 3rd of February. We head to Indiana. We are planning to be in California next January and February because it'll be much easier. Traveling across the north end of the country in February is not easy. And we'll find out just how easy it is. And we're going to travel back in the end of February. And we're going to go even further north. So we'll see how it goes. We have a missions conference in Indiana in February, and then we'll be there for 2 weeks in northern Indiana, and then we'll move up to, if it's just in case it's not cold enough, we're going to go north up to Wisconsin for the last 2 weeks of February. I was telling Brother Dennis, we have... there's a group called Wings as Eagles. It's a group that does missions aviation training, and they own quite a few aircraft around the world with different missionaries. So they do a lot of different things, but mostly in relation to aviation. And a friend of ours is a missionary in Cameroon, and they have an airplane that's owned by Wings as Eagles. Our church built the airplane, and then it's been since flown to Wisconsin, and it's sitting there. It hasn't been able to get to Cameroon because of all the political stuff going on there, and so it's still in Wisconsin now. It's coming up on an annual. They're kind of working on trying to get this annual done, and then they got two other aircraft they're trying to work on. So they asked if I was going to be in the area, and they would love some help getting some maintenance done on these aircraft. So it's a good opportunity for us, because if we do end up getting into Australia with the aviation maintenance or the pilot stuff, it would be good to have something written down saying this is what I've done, actual maintenance outside of the school. So that's a good opportunity. It's also a good relationship to have. People in aviation is a good thing to have. So that's our goal. We're planning on spending about 2 weeks there, and then we head back here in March, the first week of March. Rebecca and Emily are going on a missions trip, not to Australia, to Mexico. Our church does a missions trip every couple years with our teens, and Emily had already been planning to go, and they needed a responsible adult female to go. So they asked my wife to go as well. So I'll be around here with four kids, so pray for me. I don't know how she does it. So, actually, oddly enough, we had already planned, we already had a missions conference planned here in Salem the week that she's gone. So I will take four kids to a missions conference. That'll be fun. So anyway, they're a huge help. So I'll let them set up the table and see how it looks. Yeah. So that's what February and March looks like. Then we head back in April. We're still trying to figure this one out. We actually have to go back to Wisconsin in April, but just for a week, and we're not allowed to have the kids with us this time. So this is a training session we have to have with our board, and they have their ways of saying things kindly. They say, "We trust that you'll be able to find someone to watch your kids for a week." So we're gonna fly out there in April, into April, for a week for that, and then we'll be back. And then our kind of next thing, then we got another training in June in Alabama, and then we've got a missions conference in October in Michigan. And between that, we're trying to figure out where to put things. So we have several churches in Indiana, Michigan, Illinois that we would like to schedule, but we're trying to figure out when we're going to be there. And I really don't want to go back and forth across the country too many times. It costs a lot of money. It costs a lot of money. I was floored when I did the math, and I was like, wow, this is expensive. So I don't want to do that too many times. And we also have quite a few churches in California we're trying to work out a schedule with. So just trying to figure out how to schedule all that is kind of the complicated part. But starting to get rolling. So we're trying to get there. We definitely still, that is our primary focus right now, is filling up the schedule right now. That's really consuming everything. If we can get that, the other stuff will probably start to fall into place. So any other questions? Yeah.
So the rumor we heard was that you're going to take the truck and the trailer, plus the suburban that we're going to go around this room.
That is correct.
Is that still the way?
Yep. Yeah, so there's been a lot of steps along the way over the past almost six years. One of the steps, initial steps that we did the math on, we found that the truck and the trailer were the way to go, rather than trying to stay in hotels and profit chambers. So when we made that decision, we said, okay, this is how we're gonna do it. And then we started looking for trucks and trailers. Then we found out we were pregnant. And with seven of us, there's not a truck that fits seven of us unless we go Klein style. And I can't find one of those trucks. Some of you know what that truck looks like. Those are not very easy to find. So a normal truck does not seat seven people. So we said, okay, how are we gonna do this? So we decided we're gonna have to end up driving two vehicles. So originally we thought, well, let's just keep the car. We had the Impala and we were gonna keep the car. Way cheaper to drive that. But when we put it together, we realized then everywhere we go, we would have to take both cars. Literally, we couldn't go somewhere, stop, park the truck and trailer, and go someplace. We'd have to take the truck and the car. So we said, it's better to take the Suburban. Everybody can fit in the Suburban. That way we can go park the truck and trailer, and we just go to a church or wherever in the Suburban. I have this thing. I don't want to show up at a church looking like the Beverly Hillbillies. You know, everything's all like stuck on the back. You know, I got suitcases hanging out. I mean, it's not a bad thing. It can work for some people, but that's just not me. So I kind of like to be a little bit more composed when I show up. And so we felt like the Suburban was a better fit, and it allows us to park the truck and trailer at times and just travel without it, shorter trips. And so that's kind of actually formed how we focus as well. When we go to a place, we're kind of designing it where we would park in somewhat in the middle spot and drive 40 minutes is fine to a church service, but then 40 minutes the other direction, the next, whatever, you know. So it kind of has formed how we plan things as well. So it'll work. to be honest, it doesn't bother me because I like driving. It's just kind of, I've done it so much, I just don't really care that much. She's not used to it as much, so we'll see how this goes. But they're both four-wheel drive, so I'm not worried about that. We'll see.
Who's going to be leading?
Yeah, exactly.
The Lord is
leading. Yes, exactly. We'll see how this goes. It'll be interesting. So this trip is actually somewhat of a short trip, a one-month trip in the north in the winter. So we'll see how this goes, and this will probably dictate how we determine to do things later as it goes along. So, yeah. Any other questions? What time are we done? 11:45? Oh, okay. Okay, well, if there's no other questions, then let's open our Bibles to 1 Samuel chapter 17. And some of you who know me are thinking this isn't good, but I promise I will be fast and I will be done on time. Or at least I promise you I will try. 1 Samuel chapter 17, this is an interesting topic. Everybody knows this topic. There's nothing real crazy about the story, nothing new, obviously, about the story of David and Goliath. But actually, in this particular time, I'm just actually going to look at the kind of the story before David and Goliath. So how did David come to the situation that he was in when he got to the point where he's now fighting Goliath? If we fast forward the story, where David is standing there in front of Goliath ready to sling a stone. That's going to be the end of the story. So let's start before that. And the reason I say this, I did some research a while back when I was writing this, and there's a website called adherence.com, and they claim to be, just like everybody else, the expert on their field. And they say that in the world, so we have about, I think we're right over 7 billion on the planet, I think 7.2, I think is the last thing I saw, billion people, right? Of those, there are 2.4 that are listed as Christian. So 2.4 billion Christians. Now, I have a feeling that most of you probably agree with me that that's probably a fairly skewed number. I highly doubt that there are 2.4 billion Christians on this planet. I know for a fact there are not 2.4 billion people acting like Christians on this planet. I can tell you that. It would be a very different planet, I can tell you that. Let's go with that number just because it's fine. We can go with that. It says that according to them, the next largest religion is Islam at 1.8 billion. So actually pretty comparable number. And then third is a group that they kind of stuck together as what they would call secularist, atheist, agnostic, not religious, whatever you want to call that. And that one, I believe, is 1.2 billion. So if you took 7.2, I think is what we have on the planet now, 7.2 minus the 2.4, assume that those people are good Christians going to churches, 2.4 billion people. That still leaves us with over 4 billion people on this planet, probably closer, almost 5 billion people on this planet that don't even claim to be Christian. In fact, you have 1.8 billion people that specifically claim that the Bible was corrupted and had to be replaced by the Quran. So 1.8 billion people, that's enough right there just to kind of steer our focus a little bit, right? In this case, here's my point. If there are for something billion people that don't even claim to know to be Christians, I would say a pretty decent number of those don't even know Christ. I would argue that of those 2.4 billion that claim to be Christian, There are many of those that don't actually even know the gospel story. How many Christians, how many Catholics in South America alone don't, in all likelihood, don't even know the truth of the gospel? I would say the number is probably pretty staggering. And so, because, I mean, almost that entire continent claims to be Christian, but the Catholic, which I don't think counts, and so the number is very skewed. So if you looked at just that, that would tell us that there's a big, big, enormous task ahead of us, right? So humanly speaking, we would say that there's no possible way we're going to even if we just said, let's go after the Muslims, 1.8 billion people, there's no chance in my lifetime that I or any number of friends helping me could change that number drastically, right? Even if I was to say, look, I'm going to get that down to 1 million Islam. That's an impossible task, right? But chipping away at it, absolutely, it's possible. And of course, with God, Jesus Christ said, with God, all things are possible. So we know that it is possible for people to understand. And the other thing is that we also know that regardless of whether they change their minds and become Christians, understand the gospel, all our job is to tell them. God did not tell us to change their minds. So if we view our job as to tell them, that's still a pretty enormous task. That's a lot of people on this planet that need to be told, right? So that's obviously should be the mission of all Christians, right? That is our mission. And there are a significant number of those that are in the unsaved category that are here. In fact, I would say this town in particular has a pretty significant number of those. So there's a big task. It's a big task. But here's the point. I would argue that it's a battle. And this is where I'm comparing it. David had a battle that he was facing. Fast forward to the end of the story, almost the end of the story. David standing in front of Goliath, ready to hit him with a stone. And he is fully aware that he is in a battle at this point. In fact, back up just a little bit more, he shows up to the battle. He hears the roar, because his dad had told him to come and bring this food, and he hears the roar of the battle, he hears things going on, and he starts asking questions. What's going on? There's something going on. There's not just people camped across opposite hills of each other staring at each other. There's something going on. What's going on? And of course, his oldest brother says, you're just coming here because you wanted to see the action. You're not, challenging his intent. And David basically ignores him. And he says, is there not a cause? He makes this statement. Is there not a cause? There's a battle. He realized immediately there's a battle, and there's a reason why there's a battle. It's not just a battle because two people wanted the same piece of property. That was not the battle. David points out that it wasn't about this piece of property, it was about the name of God. So, we'll back up even further. We see in verse 32, look at 1 Samuel 17 and verse 32, David's talking to Saul. Saul has now heard about the fact that David has shown up, and David says to Saul, let no man's heart fail him, thy servant will go and fight this Philistine. I'll go. And of course, he gets a little kickback from Saul. He says, thou art not able to go against this Philistine to fight with him, for thou art but a youth, and he a man of war from his youth. He was fighting before he were even born, is what he said. That's my terms. David responds, thy servant kept his father's sheep, and there came a lion and a bear and took a lamb out of the flock, and I went after him and smote him and delivered it out of his mouth. And when he arose against me, I caught him by his beard and smote him and slew him. Thy servant slew both the lion and the bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine shall be as one of them, seeing he hath defied the armies of the living God. He goes on, but what we realize is that David was fully aware that he was in a battle. This was a physical battle, so it's a little easier to see. But we are in a battle for, we might say, to change men's hearts, but we don't do that. God does that. But we are in a battle. God and the devil are in a battle to change men's hearts. And we are our part of the battle is not to change them, but to share with them the truth that the devil has distorted, so that they have an opportunity to see God's side. Right now, they don't see God's side. They can't even see it. The devil has distorted it so much. In fact, go out there. How many churches are in the city of Corvallis alone? And I guarantee you that there's not a single one of them that is actually preaching the whole truth of God today. This is the only one. I am convinced of that. I've been in this town a long time. It's been a little while, so maybe there's another one that I don't know about recently, but that has been the case for a lot of years. So my point is, the devil is using every single one of them to distort that message. And that's all they hear. It's noise. They hear this noise of a distorted message. So our job is to help correct that message so that they hear the truth. They get rid of all of this news that's floating in the air, that's garbage, that doesn't mean anything, that's a distortion of the truth, and hear just the pure truth of the gospel. And that's our job. That's the role that God has given each one of us. David recognized that battle. Sometimes we forget that that's a battle, that that is a battle. And sometimes it takes a chunk out of us. Sometimes we feel down, we feel discouraged because we got hit. The devil came at us because he has power. He's the prince of the power of the air. He absolutely has power in this earth, and he definitely makes our life rough at times. And God allows it because he knows, but he uses it. Can we say that God is? We're allowing God to use it? And I want three things and I'm done. I want to look first at his purpose. In verse 36, David had a purpose. In verse 36, it says, "Thy servant slew both the lion and the bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine shall be as one of them." Why? "Seeing he hath defied the armies of the living God." It really wasn't about the armies. It was more about the defied the living God. And he knew that that was not, that should not stand. He should not be allowed to stand there and defy who God is. And all of these Israelite men, all these men of war, supposed to be well-trained army, are standing there staring at him, letting him do it. And David said, "I may be just a kid, but I'm not going to let him do that. I will die trying." But see, the thing is, as Christians, a lot of times, we see the devil doing this to people, and we say, "You know what? I'm going to stand there and watch. There's somebody that's going to do it. Who's going to be the one that says I'm going to die trying?" The problem is, so often, we see. Look at those missionaries, what they go through. You guys know the Herzls. I mean, the physical struggles that they have gone through. It's difficult. Many missionaries go through these physical struggles every day. We know a missionary, Dave Olson, he went to Zambia. He got hit. He was in a car accident, and he's never been the same. In fact, he came and preached at our church, and as soon as he was done preaching, he went and sat down and had a seizure while sitting in the chair. He can't function for very long at a time. And he could look back and he could say, "God, you took me to Zambia, and then you put me in this car." He can't even be in Zambia anymore. He's back in the States, and he goes on short trips if he can. But even those, he's afraid of just collapsing completely. He gets seizures, and Lord, why did you allow this? The devil does these things, and the Lord allows it for a purpose. What's the purpose? Maybe it's to inspire others? I don't know. But we do know that God has a purpose in this, and people go through things. You have to know that people do go through things to share the gospel with others. It's not going to be where you can sit in your living room in a comfortable chair and share the gospel with everybody, and it's all going to be good. That's just how that's going to be my ministry, is sitting in my comfortable chair sharing the gospel as people come to me, because they don't. That's not how it works. We have to go to them. It's much more difficult. So that doesn't, all for everybody, that doesn't mean going to Zambia. God has not called me to Zambia. God has called every one of us to somewhere, and maybe that's here right now. And in fact, for us, it's not Australia right now. God has not called us to Australia right now. God has called us here right now. And so our focus is here. And as we move, God has called us to each of these places. And as eventually, our goal is to be in Australia. God has called each one of us to a place with a purpose. David had a purpose. He also had a process. Keep in mind, David didn't show up at Goliath, say, "I'm going to sling this stone and see what happens, because, I don't know, someone said you can sling a stone with a leather thing, whatever the thing is," right? That's not what he said. He had practiced, right? Not only that, he had killed this lion and this bear without the stone, by the way. Right. He had killed him in hand to hand, which I can tell you right now I would not have done. I would have let him... I don't know. I'm pretty sure I would have let him have the sheep. I would have taken the rest of them and said bye, and I would have probably not challenged a physical fight with a bear or a lion, either one. And by the way, I was doing some research on this. I was wondering about this. I thought maybe there's some mountain lions or something like that, which, by the way, are not just, you know, but still, not like an African lion, right? No, no. They apparently had, they're called Asiatic lions that they used to have. They don't have them anymore, but in Israel, they used to have these Asiatic lions. They were the same size. You're talking about 450-pound lion. That he takes on as a 17-year-old kid. I mean, that takes some guts right there. I just don't think I would have done that. They also had some brown bears that were similar to California brown bears. So not small animals that he took on. These weren't. It wasn't like he took on a baby lion or something like that. This was a full-grown, very large lion, and he took it down. Why? Because God gave him. But God had a purpose, but he had a process that he went through. He went through a process where God trained him through that process. So if you think, okay, I've decided that's what God's calling me to, I'm going to go out and start witnessing to people, great. That is fantastic. Make sure that you have a process. Not that you have to do all these seven steps for something, but make sure that you have a training process, that you know what you're doing. Otherwise, it's so easy to get so discouraged and find out you're missing a piece. There's a process. There's a process. David was taken through a process. God took him through a process where eventually he showed up one day and there's Goliath. But that wasn't all of a sudden one day, hey, I think we should start fighting things. Okay, take on that thing. It wasn't that way. It was a process. And then, of course, thirdly, he had his Philistine. He had this giant task that God brought him to that he could not accomplish without God. But not only that, every other man there, Saul being head and shoulders above every man in Israel, was hiding in his tent. He was not even willing to go take this guy on. And yet, David was ready because God had brought him through this process and had given him a purpose to accomplish. And then, of course, we have to have God with us, or else we can't accomplish that. He had that giant. One day, maybe you've had it already, maybe you have another one coming, but one day you will have a Philistine. You will have your giant that comes along. That's the thing that God's been training you for all this time. And you wonder sometimes, why does God put me through these things? Because I don't see the end result. I haven't seen how this is ever going to get used. And one day it will come, and you may look back and say, that's why God brought me through that, because I would not have been able to accomplish that had he not brought me through that, and that, and that, and that, through this whole process. And if we're not willing to accept the process now, we will never get to the point of being able to fight that Philistine, and we'll be standing there just like all the rest of those Israelite men, wondering what to do, watching God be defied. That's not what he wants. That's not his goal. So our goal is to get as much as we can through the process that he's using to train us, so that one day we'll get there and maybe we'll know, maybe we won't. Maybe we'll be like, wait, was that the giant? That was easy. I mean, it's not like it was all that difficult for David. He walked out there, grabbed five stones. He only needed one, and then he stood there and cut his head off. Like, it was pretty easy, right? This wasn't several hours of fighting, and you know, it seems easy. He might have looked back and thought, that was it? But that's because God brought him through that process, and he allowed himself to be trained and be ready, and he was ready. He was ready for that day, and mentally even, just prepared. We have to be prepared, and it takes that process and that purpose. Let's close in prayer. Dear Heavenly Father, we thank you for the purpose that you have for every single one of us here, our broader purpose to being to show you to the world that you would be glorified, because we know that in the end, every knee will bow and every tongue will confess you are God, and it will glorify you, Lord. We know this. That is the purpose that we all have, but we all have purposes underneath that as well, Lord. You have a purpose for every single one of our lives, and you have a purpose for our training, our process that you've taken us through, Lord, and you will give us a giant one day. You have a goal for us to reach.
And that may seem daunting right now, but Lord, you will bring us through it, and we trust you for it. Lord, I pray that you would just help each one of us to grow through that and be ready for the task that you've called us to. I pray that you'd be with us the rest of our services today. And I pray all these things in your name. Amen.